Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program that addresses challenges faced regionally, the need for and the consequences of change, and how today's choices impact tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. The day after the Sandy Hook tragedy, Shannon Watts, a mother of five, started a Facebook group with the message that all Americans can and should do more to reduce gun violence. The simple act was the beginning of Moms Demand Action, which since its beginning has established a volunteer chapter in every state of the country and Washington, D.C., and is part of Every Town for Gun Safety, the largest gun violence prevention organization in the country with more than 8 million supporters. Chris Kington Barker is your host today and will be talking with a volunteer of Moms Demand Action. You are invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation. You can call in your questions to be part of today's discussion at 805-549-8855 or email them to voices@kcbx.org. Over to you, Chris.
We're also two of the deadliest years on record for another public health crisis, gun violence. The United States saw a 34% increase from 2019 to 2020 in the rate of home gun homicides. This upward trend continued but slowed through the end of 2021, during which time there was an additional 7% increase in gun homicides relative to 2020. Their website acknowledges that despite limited funding and inconsistent data collection, data on the city of gun violence is too often old, incomplete, and conflicting from one federal agency to another. They do their best to provide the most recent stats available. In today's show, some of the references will be brought up by my guest and spoken to. And my guest is Michelle Garner, volunteer and national training team lead with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And Michelle, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to admit, I wasn't really familiar with this group at all before I got the information I was doing today's show. So I'm really interested in having you as a guest. And I'm curious, how did you get involved in this group and why?
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for having me. I got involved about 5 years ago. I have twin sons, and when they were 5 years old and starting kindergarten, there were several mass shootings on the news, and I was terrified. And I couldn't shake this feeling every day that I dropped them off at school that how many families in America have done this, drop their kids off at school, thinking it's a normal day, race off to work, and then never see their child again. And I just could not shake that feeling, especially with, you know, when it's your first kid or kids going to school and you're anxious anyway, and then you have that on top of it. And so I started doing some research and trying to figure out, you know, what can I do? Are there groups out there? How can I quell this feeling? And I found Moms Demand Action. And the more research I did on them, I realized everything they do is fact-based and data-based. It's not just emotion or impulse. We look at what are the facts, what works, what helps save lives. So I got involved and started volunteering and got a little group together here in Slo County. And the more time I spent in the movement, I realized that while mass shootings and school shootings are horrible, they're a relatively small percentage of gun deaths in America. And the majority of gun deaths are suicide or homicide. And that's when I realized that I am actually a gun violence survivor, in that I'm a suicide loss survivor, and I've lost two family members to suicide by gun. And so that has become another reason why I do the work I do, is to save other families from that experience. And so over time, I've gotten involved with training new volunteers at the state and national level, and I just love how empowered Moms Demand has made me feel in this area.
How long ago did you get involved?
It was 2017 when I first
Okay.
started, so it's been about 5 years. Yeah.
Yeah, and you've seen quite a few changes since then, have you not?
Absolutely, yes. And I'm glad you brought that up, because so many people say nothing has changed since Sandy Hook, and that's just not true. While there's so many things I think most of us Americans would like to see different, and those things maybe haven't happened, there have been changes. So many laws enacted, so many bad gun laws defeated, and a lot of education, public education on suicide prevention and safe gun storage. We get so much done. So we're always making change. We are kind of a movement of incrementalism. Sometimes it feels that these little wins are small, but they really are what makes change and positive change in our country. Absolutely.
You know, with change you talk about happening, the changes that potentially could come about that are before the Senate right now that are up for vote.
Absolutely.
What, you know, from the perspective of your group, is that encouraging?
Absolutely. Yes. We, you know, like I said, I'm sure there are many of us listening in right now, many of us across the nation that want more drastic change. But as an organization, we are over the moon about this package, the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which is up for vote and passed another vote again today, because the things that are included in this bill really will save lives. And we do have bipartisan support. No bill is going to be perfect, but they really do make a difference. So some of the things included in there are enhancing background checks for buyers under 21. We've seen a lot of these mass shootings lately perpetrated by 18 to 21 year olds. And this enhanced background check really requires federally licensed firearm dealers to do a little bit more exploring, contact the local police department or school district police department, see if there's been any concerns in this young person's background that maybe wouldn't pop up on a traditional background check. So it takes a little bit more time and provides some of that cooling off period. It provides just a tremendous amount of federal funding to support the implementation of red flag laws, what they're commonly called red flag laws, but just crisis intervention services in all 50 states. Money will be available and allocated to the states to implement that how they see fit. Many states do have red flag laws, but not all. And so this federal funding will allow states to, you know, staff the departments that are needed to manage that, or the courts, or however they need to use their funds make those things happen and keep guns out of the hands, with due process, of course, out of the hands of people who are a threat to themselves or others. Some other things in this really important bill are disarming domestic abusers. So there are still states where convicted domestic abusers can legally purchase more guns and keep the guns they have. So this will prevent people who are convicted of domestic abuse from purchasing more guns. Again, due process is involved. They will be able to get their guns back if they continue to be a one-time offender. They don't repeat offend. We know that 50 women per month in America, at least 50 women on average, die at the hands of domestic abusers. So whether that's their intimate partner, their spouse. So this will go a long way to saving lives. And there are a lot of other pieces in this bill. It also includes money for school safety funding and investing in mental health services, which are big issues that have bipartisan support. So there's a lot of great stuff in this bill. I know some people were hoping for an assault weapons ban or other different things, raising the legal age for purchasing an AR-15 to 21, or, you know, a lot of people have different things they wanted. This is a great bill, and it absolutely will save lives. And we've seen in our movement that, you know, once some bills get passed and some laws are implemented, over time, we are able to gather the data to show this really works. Okay, now can we tweak it a little bit more? Can we, you know, how else can we streamline it to continue to save lives?
There, with red flag laws, there have been some states that have been much more aggressive about red flag laws. Have those had a good impact? And if so, what kind of advance have you seen with properly implemented red flag laws?
Absolutely. And red flag laws, what are, they're called extreme risk protection orders, also known as red flag laws. And the reason they're called red flag laws is so many times, especially in mass shootings, but also just in homicide and suicide, the family or friends or coworkers saw red flags, and they'll come out later and say, oh, he was acting erratically, or I saw him online talking about shooting up a school. So those are the red flags. Most of the time, almost across the board, someone saw a red flag. And so these red flag laws are designed that close family, you know, the people you live with, in some states, it's also, you know, coworkers or like a counselor. So it has to be someone close to you, can go petition for a temporary restraining order, talk to law enforcement and say, you know, this guy at work has been saying this and that. I'm concerned he's a threat to himself or others. And then they go through due process. It does have to go, you know, law enforcement looks into it. It goes before a judge for a hearing. And then if the person is deemed to be a threat, those weapons are removed. Again, temporarily, you can get your weapons back once it is shown that you're no longer in that crisis mode. You're no longer deemed a threat to yourself or others. And we saw in cases like Parkland, there was no red flag law there at the time. And police had been called to his house over 30 times. So people knew something was wrong. They were concerned, but there was nothing they could do until he broke the law, until he killed all these people at school. And so if a red flag law had been in place, it very possibly could have prevented that. And there are other situations we see all the time. And it's not just mass shooters. It is people who are maybe at risk for suicide, mm-hmm. or, you know, a domestic violence situation, anyone in crisis, they've lost their job and they're behaving erratically. So we do have the data to show in states with these red flag laws, they do save lives. I know Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut was just talking last night on the news about how they recently used it in Connecticut and were able to remove guns from a young man who had plans to do a school shooting. So they do save lives. And again, they're written carefully so that they protect people's due process rights and their right to own and bear firearms as written in the Constitution.
You know, when we talk about some of the other things that are coming, there's a lot of anxiety around this whole topic. There's been a whole lot of pushback from some people who really feel as though they're, you know, and genuinely feel their rights are being violated by any kind of implementation of more governance, more rules around their rights to owning anything. On the other side, there are people that have compared this to other areas where there's been more rules instituted for safety and protection. One of the examples that I've seen over and over again is vehicle drivers and what we can and can't do, rules around seatbelts, rules around child protective seats. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely, yes. And one thing I do love about Moms Demand Action is we're not anti-gun and we're not anti-gun owner. We have plenty of gun owners in our membership, hunters. One of our leaders at the national level is a gun collector and gun enthusiast. So we're not at all anti-gun or anti-gun owner. We're pro common sense. And the majority of gun owners in America are. There's a very vocal minority who, like you said, they don't want their rights infringed at all. But as our founder, Shannon Watts, often says, the Constitution and the Second Amendment are not a suicide pact. And there are Supreme Court decisions such as Heller that support the idea that there can be reasonable regulations on the Second Amendment. For example, you can't own a machine gun. You know, there are regulations in place. And Moms Demand Action is for common sense legislation. We're not about taking people's guns away. You'll hear that a lot. People will say, oh, they're taking our guns away. We're not about that at all. We just know that there are common sense solutions we can implement that really will save lives. And such as the example you gave with cars, just in my lifetime, I've seen the implementation of the seatbelt law. And when that happened, I know people were upset about it. There were people mm-hmm. who said, you can't tell me to wear my seatbelt. And as those laws, such as seatbelt laws and car seat laws were implemented and insurance laws, you know, laws around drivers having to have insurance or, you know, drunk driving laws. There's been changes to the laws of blood alcohol limits. And as those laws are implemented, we've seen death in car accidents and automobile related deaths go down. And as we have seen, sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, the states with the toughest gun laws, they still have gun deaths. And while it's true, they do still have some gun deaths, the data shows the states with the toughest gun laws have the fewest gun deaths. So California, we do have strict gun laws here. And even though we do have gun deaths, the rate of gun death is so much lower than other states with lax gun laws. Mm-hmm. So laws do work. We're not trying to take your guns. But we do want to see some common sense things implemented that keep us all safer, such as background checks and waiting periods and things like that.
Something that you had mentioned at first was when, you know, the idea that what's really gotten our attention recently is the mass gun use and the mass killings that have happened. And just seem to be happening more and more. And they get such wide publicity, but that's really a fraction. And it's a horrible fraction of the deaths that are occurring as a result of guns.
Right.
Far more people. And I think right now, it used to be that automotive accidents or vehicle accidents were the number one reason for deaths in children in this country, correct? And now is gun violence.
Absolutely. So just in the 5 years that I've been volunteering in this space, I've seen that change. That, and I think it's actually just been in the last year. It's been since the pandemic, with this huge increase in gun sales during the pandemic, that guns have become the leading cause of death for children and teens in America. And that's just unacceptable. As a parent, and my husband's a teacher, I just think of all these kids and teens out there. That's unacceptable. We're, you know, we always say we're the greatest country in the world, and yet we have this very preventable problem. And those gun deaths for children and teens, suicide is a big piece of that. So it's not just the mass shootings like you talked about. Those are horrible, and they capture our passion and our imagination, as they should, because they really are tragic and horrible. But as you said, it's a small percentage of gun deaths in America. A lot of kids and teens are dying by suicide. They die by what we call unintentional shootings. So their caregiver parent has left a gun unlocked and loaded where the kid has access, and, you know, unintentional shootings happen. They're messing around with the gun or moving it and it goes off. That happens quite a bit. And homicide, we see that as well. Kids turning guns on each other when they have easy access. So absolutely, you're correct. And I'm sure many listeners are shocked to hear that it is the leading cause of death of kids and teens now in America. And it doesn't have to be that way. We absolutely can make change.
Yeah, when you talk about the increase in numbers of guns during the pandemic, a couple of things just really flash to mind for me. Something that I've noticed and I've seen written about has been the shift in marketing for gun owners that has taken place. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So, you know, there really is a tremendous amount of intentional marketing of firearms, especially to young men. We see it in, you know, online on YouTube ads and, you know, when they're playing on these video game spaces. It really is intentional marketing to teens, appealing to the sense of masculinity, being a real man, being a warrior. So we do see that. We see also a lot of fear mongering type advertisement I've seen in lots of ads. I don't know if I mentioned, I have a lot of hunters and gun enthusiasts in my extended family. Mm-hmm. And I've seen in magazines at their homes, you know, hunting magazines and things. There are ads that really are kind of that fear mongering, you know, this idea that they are coming for you and you need more weapons and, you know, this is your masculinity and that sort of thing. So this really intentional marketing has tremendously increased gun sales. We see huge spikes in gun sales after these mass shootings. So as horrified as everyone is by Uvalde and other mass shootings we've seen lately, Buffalo, we see huge gun sales spikes because the marketing starts up again, not just ads, but on talk shows and news shows and podcasts, they're saying, oh, well, now this happened. They are going to come for your guns.
Right.
They're going to take your guns away. You are not going to be able to buy these anymore. You need to go out and buy them. And people do. We see these huge spikes after each mass shooting event. We saw them leading up to the 2016 election. A lot of people thought Clinton was going to win, and if she came into power, that she would implement an assault weapons ban. And so we saw a huge spike in AR-15 sales and other guns with mass shooting capacity. And then during the Trump years, we saw what we called a Trump slump, because people thought, okay, they're not going to take our guns away now. And so the sales dropped off. And so there really is a lot of fear mongering trying to drum up gun sales. And as a result of that, especially during the pandemic, there was a lot of fear peddling about, you know, scarcity. When we had things like the toilet paper shortage, people getting this idea that there's not enough, there's going to be rioting, there's going to be lawlessness, you need more guns. We saw this huge spike in gun sales, and now we have more guns on the streets than ever. We have over 400 million guns in America right now. That's enough for basically every man, woman, and child in the country to have one. And they're in the hands of people who haven't been trained. You know, they bought them impulsively. So they probably aren't storing them correctly. And that's dangerous. And we've seen the results in spikes in gun deaths in the last 2 years.
And if people are not familiar with guns or trained properly, they're going to leave them loaded because they're not going to feel comfortable that they can load them, prepare them, and use them if whoever that entity is comes for them. They need to protect themselves. Right. So you're going to have children access them. And kids,
Absolutely. You
know, on the other side of that, kids think from all the video games and what we see on TV, people get pummeled with bullets, get up and start walking again.
It's just
this impracticality of what is happening. I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener supported radio station. With me today is Michelle Garner, volunteer and national training team lead with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. We're talking about Moms Demand Action as a grassroots movement fighting for public safety measures that can help protect people from gun violence. And we're inviting you to bring your comments about today's topic into our discussion. To do that, you can call 805-549-8855, or you can email to voices@kcbx.org, and we'll pick up your email and answer your questions or bring your comments on air. And Michelle, with that whole fear marketing, you know, and that hoarding or that fear of not having enough or needing to make sure that we protect ourselves, I've actually heard from people about the red flag laws. The fear about that is contrary to what they're intended to do, which is protect people sometimes from themselves and sometimes to protect other people. So for someone who's in a mental health crisis, for someone who is feeling or having suicidal ideations, for them to have a red flag act in place feels to them as a way that they would end up losing their guns. How do you address that?
Right. And so there is, like you said, there is a lot of fear with some people around red flag laws. And red flag laws are very carefully drafted. You know, for anything to get passed through a state house or at the federal level, they're very carefully drafted legislation. And they have to have bipartisan support to get through. And they're drafted so that they are protecting the person's due process rights and their right to the Second Amendment to own and bear arms, but their common sense to protect, like you said, the person from themselves or protect other people. So a red flag law, if someone thinks perhaps their neighbor or their husband or whoever is a danger to themselves or others, they petition for this extreme risk protection order. So basically, it's a temporary restraining order so that law enforcement can remove the firearms from this person. And there is due process. Like I said earlier, it usually goes to an emergency hearing before a judge. So it's a pretty rapid process. It does go through due process, and the person can get their guns back, absolutely, as long as they are deemed to no longer be a threat to themselves or others. And we saw this accessed here locally just a few years ago with the Women's March. There was someone threatening the organizers of the Women's March and to shoot up the Women's March, and the red flag law was invoked, and he did have firearms that could have done significant damage, and they were removed. And then law enforcement is also able to check in regularly and see, has this person obtained more firearms? And it can protect people. And like I said, they can get their weapons back. So if it's someone who's suicidal and a family member is concerned and they go through the process and the firearms are removed and that person gets counseling or whatever they need and they're through their crisis, they can get those firearms back. It's not permanent. And that in the federal bill that's going through right now that may be approved, that's in there as well, that people can get their firearms back. There's, you know, there's not this mythical force that's going to be coming and removing everyone's guns forever. And and they are carefully drafted so that it's not anyone with a vengeance trying to take someone's guns from them. It has to be someone with close knowledge of the person. Most state laws are drafted so that it's immediate family or an employer or like a counselor. So someone with immediate knowledge of the person. It's not a disgruntled ex-boyfriend or girlfriend or something like that.
You so talked about the background checks and the for under 21, right? And enhancing that. Are there places where those records are closed because it's a minor?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so how does that come into effect?
I think across the board, juvenile records are sealed in most cases.
Right. So how would they access?
Yeah. Right. So the federal background check system right now, you go through a background check to buy a gun if you're going through a federally licensed firearms dealer. So something like a gun shop. But there are plenty of states where it's perfectly legal to buy a gun online. There's a site called Arms List. It's a lot like Craigslist, but it's for guns. You can buy a gun at a yard sale. You can buy a gun off somebody's pickup truck bed in a lot of states. And so those types of sales aren't subject to background check. And that's how a lot of guns get into the hands of the wrong people. Now, as far as making this federally licensed firearm dealer, they're looking at expanding the definition of that in this new package that's going through Senate so that more dealers have to register as federally licensed dealers. So people who are selling guns online in other states, doing more person-to-person sales, would have to register and do those background checks. And right now, basically, they kind of run your name through this federal system. And if you've popped up as having felonies, violent arrests, that sort of thing, those are the sort of things that show up on these background checks. Whereas for these, now this expanded background check for 8 to 21-year-olds would be allowed to call the local police station or sheriff's station and see, is this person, this young man, usually it's a young man, is this known to the local law enforcement? Have you had run-ins? Has the family been in crisis? That sort of thing. They can state and local courts before the sale proceeds. So again, it's very new. I don't know all the text to it, but it kind of circumvents some of those sealed youth records because a lot of times there have been red flags. I know just a few months ago, there was a school shooting in Michigan where he had threatened school shootings. He had done these violent drawings. They had spoken to school counselors, but you know, sometimes those things don't go through a traditional background check system. But by the seller having to call the local police station and talk to them, they can find some things out that maybe can prohibit these sales.
Okay. But it would take more time.
Yes, takes more time. And luckily this bill, this large bill that's going through, has a lot of funding, which we haven't had before. Federal funding to states, it'll be allocated by a formula so that each state gets money they need to implement these things. Because like you said, it takes time, it takes staffing, you know, it takes our ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms is understaffed and has been for years. We need more people to do this work, this life-saving work.
Thank you. Well, we're going to take a break right now. And Donna, I'm going to hand it back to you. And we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you, Chris. Support comes from California Mid-State Fair in Paso Robles, presenting an evening of music and wine with John Fogerty on July 29th. Tickets are available now at midstatefair.com. Right now on kcbx.org, just a reminder, you can watch as the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol continues its public hearings. Today's hearing will continue through the day until an undetermined time. You can watch live on our website at kcbx.org. Central Coast Voices continues with host Chris Kington Barker.
Thank you, Donna. And I love that music. Oh my gosh. What a nice break for the topic that we're talking about. We're going to welcome back to Central Coast Voices Michelle Garner, volunteer national training team lead with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America is my guest today. And a reminder that if you have a question for today's guest or a comment about our discussion, we welcome hearing from you. Please call us at 805-549-8855, or you can email a comment or question about today's topic to voices@kcbx.org, and we'll bring them on the air so that we can answer or discuss them. Are you, one of the things I wanted to read out, Michelle, is I was looking at the website and I was stunned by one of the statistics that they had posted there. And it's an excellent website for really factual information, like you mentioned, about gun violence. And that website is momsdemandaction.org. And if you go to the resources section, it's where you'll be able to find a lot of the information. But one of the reports that they had is 6 out of 10 gun deaths in the United States are suicides. And that results in an average of 64 deaths a day just from suicide. The problem is getting worse. And over the past decade, the United States firearm suicide rate has increased 12%. The trend of the particular concern is for young Americans whose firearm suicide rate has increased, are you ready for this? 53% over the last 10 years. And for veterans, the firearm suicide rate 1.5 times higher than for non-veterans, which is just astounding, horrible, and so concerning. Research has also shown that having access to a firearm triples the risk of death by suicide for people. And what does that mean? Well, most people who attempt a suicide don't die unless they use a gun. Across all suicide attempts not involving firearm, are you ready for this? 4% of those people's suicide attempts result in death. Not because they didn't mean it at the time, but because it doesn't result in death. But for a suicide gun owner, for a gun suicide, those statistics, astoundingly, 90% of gun suicide attempts end in death. And that is just, that kind of took my breath away.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
And you and I were talking before we came on the air, Michelle, about the fact that both you and I have been impacted in our lives by someone who, using a gun, had attempted suicide. Mm-hmm. And I think all three were men, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to speak a little bit about that?
Sure. So as you said, beautifully, perfectly, when a firearm is involved in a suicide attempt, it is almost always lethal. You don't get that second chance. Mm-hmm. So when people attempt suicide by other means, most of the time, the majority of the time, they survive the attempt and are able to go on and get the help they need and live their life. Whereas with firearms, they're uniquely lethal. And so having access to a firearm, like you said, even just owning one, having one in the house, it significantly increases the risk of suicide. And that's because when people are in a suicidal state, it is very often impulsive. The old knowledge used to be that, you know, there were all these signs and it's a lengthy process and there's this buildup. And sometimes that's true. But the newer research shows that in many cases, the person contemplated suicide less than 10 minutes before attempting. So having access to that gun, especially if it is stored loaded, it really increases the possibility of going from a fleeting moment of crisis, feeling overwhelmed or whatever, panic, whatever the person is feeling, to an irreversible fatal decision. And that is what I've experienced in my own family. And my uncle fits what you were talking about. He's a veteran. He was a veteran, white male, and he was by all accounts a responsible gun owner until the day he decided to take his life. And there were no warning signs. Even immediate family says that nobody knew this was coming. And whatever he was feeling in that moment, it became a lethal decision because of access, easy access to a loaded gun. Mm-hmm. And so we've shown by research that when you're able, we call it interrupting access. If there's interrupted access to a firearm in a moment of crisis, it can mean all the difference between life and death. And that can be as simple as storing your gun separate from the ammunition. So storing it unloaded and separate from ammunition. Or if, you know, some people feel very passionate about needing to have a loaded firearm for protection. And if that's you, then we encourage you to please make sure it's in a safe. Or there are so many options nowadays that are inexpensive. There's even biometric safes where it has to have your fingerprint to unload it, unlock the safe. But having just even that moment of having to unlock your safe or to load the gun can make all the difference in a crisis situation. And you're absolutely right. The majority of gun deaths in America are suicides, and that's unacceptable too. It has, as you've experienced in your life and I've experienced in mine, it has a ripple effect across not just the family, but the community, the person's, right, you know, business and coworkers. And it really does impact communities. And so we want to save lives in and prevent gun violence in all its forms, including suicide.
You know, the other part of this, when I read this section, that really struck me from my experience was that a vast majority of the individuals who survive a suicide attempt do not go on to die by suicide. And, you know, so that, you know, what that speaks to is that that momentary decision, once given a chance again to either get the support they need or the counseling they need or the support they need to change the life circumstances that they're in or to sober up or to get straight or whatever it is, makes a difference. And with the person in my life, they survived a shotgun blast that they self-inflicted, unfortunately, with tremendous physical impairment. And when he was flown to University of San Francisco, and I was talking with the ICU physician, he told me that it was one of the most common injuries that they saw was the self-inflicted head wound from guns and shotguns. And it just, it absolutely astounded me. And he has never attempted suicide again, despite being so physically altered. That, you know, that astounded me.
Oh, yeah. And you bring up such good points. Another friend of mine in this movement lost her brother to suicide by gun. And he was a very young man. I believe he was 18 or 19 and going through his first breakup. And, you know, when you're young, that does feel like the end of the world. It does feel like this horrible circumstance you can't overcome. And when you have access to a firearm, he had access to firearms, and that made it a lethal moment where if he could have gotten, if it would have been easier to get the help, counseling, or, you know, just support to get through that moment than it was to have a loaded firearm around, he would still be here today, you know, and most likely would have gotten through that first breakup and never considered or attempted suicide again. So yeah, easy access to guns makes for a public health crisis in the area of suicide. Absolutely.
You know, the other thing that I was struck by was when we're talking about when they were tracing just the guns, they traced nearly 1.3 million crime guns that were traced over the period of the time that they were looking at, the 20s, more than 40% of them were used in a crime just 3 years after their initial retail sale. And those aren't even the guns that were purchased on, you know, on the street. So it, from what they were looking at, the short time to crime indicator was an indication that the guns were purposely purchased with the intention of using them for some kind of crime activity. That's really significant. That's not legal gun owners. That's not people who are protecting themselves from outside factors or protecting their families.
Yeah, there's I think there's often a misconception that bad guys with guns, they only get them illegally, like I had mentioned earlier, off the back of someone's truck or whatever. But there are plenty of people who go to gun stores and go through, you know, these legal means to purchase guns, but they do have these ideas in mind of perpetrating crimes. Even the Uvalde shooter, he purchased those guns perfectly legally, and he absolutely knew what he was going to do with them. So by making it a little tougher for people to get their hands on guns, we could definitely eliminate some of these things. And you also mentioned, you know, some of these crimes, guns being used in crimes, a lot of people will bring up places like Chicago. And the fact is, with Chicago, Illinois does have strong gun laws, but all the states around them do not. And so it's very easy for, you know, a lot of our state borders are very porous. And so it's very easy for people to cross state lines and purchase a gun perfectly legally and bring it back into the city. So there's a lot of, you know, by strengthening our gun laws federally, we can help make everyone safer.
You know, I was astounded. One of the cities that's currently one of the top cities for gun violence and gun crime right now is Fresno.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yes, Fresno and Bakersfield have huge gun violence problems. I read a recent report that Bakersfield is one of the murder capitals of California, and that's not far from here. And, you know, we know that we have lots of people visiting from the Central Valley over here for tourism and things. So it can be a security concern for us as well. That's right outside our back door. Definitely.
Well, I want to go back to some of the proposed legislation. When they talk about what may pass to be enacted to deal with some of these issues, realistically, how many years do you think it'll take to actually have anything implemented, like the funding for education or the funding for health, mental health benefits? What are we talking about?
That's a really excellent question, and I honestly don't know off the top of my head. I was just on a call about this bill yesterday, and we still don't know, you know, all the details. But if this does pass, it should be pretty soon that we will be seeing this funding going to states again to implement as they see fit within parameters. So if they are going to use this money that is allocated for supporting crisis intervention services, that can be, you know, there are stringent policies for how it can be used. So they may not want to implement a red flag law in their state for whatever reason, but they would have to use that specific funding for some sort of crisis intervention service. They can't use it in another way. So I don't know the timeline, but I do know it'll be pretty quick that states will have access to the funding. Now, whether that takes them a while to figure out how they're going to use it under the parameters, you know, that will vary. A lot of states like California, we already have a lot of great programs in place where that additional funding could just slide right in. We already have a red flag law in California. We already have a pretty significant community-based violence intervention and prevention program in California. A lot of people don't know about. It's called CalVIP. And we already have this funding in our state at the community level to help prevent gun violence. And so having this additional federal funding will allow us to just pretty quickly expand those programs. So yeah, kind of a long and short answer. I think in communities and states that don't have these things already in place, it may take longer to get them up and running, but I do believe the money will be available probably within the next budget year, I would assume.
So would this funding be able to go toward creating mental health programs? Because one of the things that we hear about here, for example, specifically for adolescents, the amount of resources, for instance, for someone who needed temporary hospitalization for stabilization, it doesn't exist here.
Right. Right. And absolutely, there's a huge investment in this bipartisan bill. There's a huge investment in mental health services. So again, money would be allocated to states based on a formula, and they can use it how it works for their state and their community based within these parameters. So it can fund community-based mental health services for children, for families, for adults, school-based mental health services, supportive services. It also provides for telehealth mental services,
right. So,
which is key for a lot of people, for a lot of different reasons. People need access to telehealth rather than having to go to a location, as well as community crisis intervention programs. So each state, each community can be creative with how they are going to use this money to best meet mental health needs in their community.
How close are we on Ethan's Law, or which, if you could talk about Ethan's Law and for storage, safe storage in the home and a requirement of that.
Right. So Ethan's Law, I'm familiar with it. It's not one that I know through and through, but it is about safe storage. And many states have safe storage laws, including California. And the problem is, you know, enforcing them is difficult. As I said, you know, ATF is understaffed, our law enforcement is understaffed. But we do have safe storage laws in a lot of states, which basically means guns need to be properly stored so that kids and teens can't access them. And really only the firearm owner can access them. And the majority of Americans, the majority of gun owners agree with this, that if you have a gun, you need to store it properly. And we at Moms Demand have worked on this issue by throughout the state, getting school districts to just send home information about it, sending home information to parents as part of the back to school packet, reminding them if you have firearms in the home, you need to store them properly, because we know that over 80% of school shooters got their gun from home. So that means the parent or guardian wasn't storing it properly, and that teenager or child was able to access it and get it to school. So Ethan's law is specifically that one, I believe, is in Connecticut. And it was when this child was 15 years old, and I believe he was at a friend's house, and they had access to an unsecured firearm, and he was killed. He was shot by this gun that wasn't properly stored at a friend's house. And because of the way the law was written, the owner of that gun couldn't be prosecuted. So Ethan's law, I don't know that that's one Moms Demand in every town have specifically worked on. But it is about safe storage and also about accountability for gun owners who don't store their firearms properly. And then it goes on to be used in a crime. So a little more responsibility for the gun owner. And we've seen that in the Michigan shooter case I brought up earlier, the school shooter, high school shooter, where the parents bought him a gun, knew he had mental concerns, didn't store it properly, and then he went on to take it to school and kill people. And so those parents are actually being charged for negligence. Yeah. And that's rare. It doesn't happen that often, but it is starting to happen more, so that we see this accountability piece for gun owners who aren't storing their gun properly. And as I mentioned earlier, it's so simple. You know, there are so many affordable options. You can buy a gun safe at Walmart. They have very cheap ones. They have the big giant floor safes that cost hundreds of dollars, but they also have very inexpensive ones. You can get a small gun safe on Amazon for about $40. So, you know, I always say, if you can afford to buy a gun, then you can afford to buy a gun safe. And it's so simple, you know, that interrupting access for kids and teens can save lives.
Absolutely. If, you know, if we're talking about making sure that you're getting important points across that you would want anybody to hear about what you've learned or what your organization is trying to impart, what are some of the key things that you want people to hear?
Sure. Well, I think you've already touched on several of them, and one of the most important ones that I want everyone to understand is that guns are the leading cause of death for kids and teens in America. And that's just tragic. You know, I believe my whole life it's been car accidents, which is also tragic, but for it in just the past couple of years to become guns is very, very sad and preventable. And over 110 people die every single day in America by gun. That's the average. So sometimes it's higher than that, but 110 people per day are dying. And when I started just 5 years ago, it was, I believe, 92. So that's a pretty big jump in just a few years for our average to go up that much. And it does not consider the hundreds more that are injured or traumatized every day, you know, being witness to a shooting or that happening in their community. It's traumatizing. And I think one of the most important things I hope every listener takes away is if you are a gun owner, to store your gun properly. Make sure that it is locked, you know, in a safe or lockbox, however you trigger lock, however you want to do that. Ideally, we recommend it is stored separately from ammunition, again, so that it takes that time, that interruption, to put you between a crisis situation and an irreversible choice. But if you are going to store it loaded, please, absolutely, it must be locked up, so kids and teens can't access it or people in crisis. And whether you own a gun or don't own a gun, we always recommend that if you're sending your kids or grandkids to someone's house for a play date or sleepover or whatever, that you ask if the family where they're going has guns, and if so, are they properly stored? And this is something I do. As I mentioned, my family, most of my family, I would say, are gun owners and mm-hmm. hunters, and you know, have guns on their property. And when we go there, we ask, you know, are your guns locked up? Because it's a simple question that can save a life, because kids are curious, teenagers are curious, they make impulsive decisions. So making sure that if someone has guns, that they're properly stored before you allow your kids to go play or stay the night there is critically important.
Yeah, you make a really good point. I think that, you know, I do work where I sometimes need to visit people in their homes. And I've gotten to a place now where I ask if they're a gun owner, do they have guns yeah. in the house? Are they properly stored? And honestly, years ago, I would never have even considered that, because it just wouldn't have occurred to me as right. as something to be bothered by whatsoever. What about, you know, as a mom in this organization, for gun owners that actually are conscientious gun owners, once an owner buys a gun, is there some kind of, I know they have to have some training, but is just being trained once to fire a weapon and then never firing it again or never handling it again, is that good enough?
Well, surprisingly, there is no training required to buy a gun. So you can buy a gun never having shot one, having no idea how to use it. And even if you never shoot it in your life, you can absolutely buy a gun with no training.
Now, that's even scarier.
Right. Now, to conceal carry, to carry it on your person or in your car here in California, there is training required now. And Moms Demand was part of that. We advocated for that and fought for it, because for many years, it was not required. Each county's sheriff or whoever handled the concealed carry permits got to make that decision. And many of them did require training. Ours did, but not all did. And so now that is wow. required in California, where you have to attend a course and show that you are proficient in using your firearm in order to carry, you know, a loaded weapon on your person in California, and you have to have a permit for it. But yeah, absolutely, you do not have to have training to buy a gun. And many people don't. One person I've talked to throughout my volunteering, we do talk to lots of people and have great conversations, gun owners, non-gun owners, people across the country. And I spoke to a woman in another state, and she had an AR-15, and she was saying the reason she had that is she wanted a gun for protection, and she told her husband to buy her the easiest one to use because she didn't know what she was doing. And so she was very upfront about it, that she said, I don't know how to shoot one, so I want one that'll be the easiest and most effective. So, right. And so there are so many people out there who own guns who haven't had training, don't know how to use them. And that's what makes this especially deadly in our society.
Well, you've not left me with a lot of comfort here whatsoever, but I really want to thank you for being here, Michelle Garner. I want to thank my guest, Michelle Garner, Volunteer National Training Team Lead with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Next week, please join Fred Monroe as he's joined by a guest with a whole nother topic of importance and interest on Thursday between 1 and 2 p.m. Central Coast Voices has been sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in a collaboration with KCBX. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining us today.
The preceding program represents the views of the speakers and not necessarily those of KCBX. KCBX welcomes the comments of those with divergent views. Our phone number is 805-549-8855.